some people. This is a follow-on to the I was just going to ask to the discussion we had on the Snowmass Day, where we had a nice presentation from Mike Kirby, but we had essentially no time for questions or discussions on any of the things that were brought up. You know, that of course has a particular Dune focus, but I think Dune is out on the lead on a lot of these sort of open, sort of the future looking neutrino questions. So my thought for this discussion today was to sort of bring back those slides, which are organized around a series of questions that the computing frontier asked the neutrino frontier, to remind ourselves of the key points from Kirby's presentation. Of the key points from Kirby's presentation, and then to essentially give opportunity for the computing folks to ask questions, which they didn't have an opportunity to do, and then to open the floor to other folks from the neutrino side if they had other thoughts, particularly if their thoughts on sort of relevant topics from experiments other than Dune that might be related to those subjects. I do see that, Heidi, you also posted some new slides today. Do you think it's urgent for us to go through those first, or can we sort of structure this around the last question and then circle back to the new material? Does that work okay for you? Heidi?
Oh, you're dropping in and out for me, so I didn't hear all of what you just said.
Is that true of everybody?
No, I could hear you well.
You're good for me.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, it was just sort of like half of each sentence was dropping out. Okay. I guess it's my problem. Yeah, okay. No, I think it's fine to, I mean, unfortunately, I'm not certain Kirby can make it today because it's really late in Europe. And so I think it's fine to review what we had. I made some slides as well, which are probably redundant with what he said.
All right, so if that's okay to you, let's get going this way. I see this meeting's already recorded. So why don't I, without further ado, I can pull up Kirby's slides again. I was just recently listening to the recording of this, so hopefully I can capture the key ideas here. The first reminder was that the idea here, our goal is to try and structure, or to try and make sure we understand what is needed from the neutrino side that we want to make sure ends up in the computing report, and what from the computing side, what questions they have for us that we might need to answer. And the computing frontier leaders gave us some questions to try and structure our thinking around those questions, right? Which is this first one: what are the concerns about computing? What keeps you up at night? What does computing need to be aware of so it ends up in the report? So I was just saying, what requirement projections do we have now related to software computing, and what existing documentation is there for them? And then are there any sort of new developments on the horizon that would drive software computing challenges? So physics, instrumentation, simulations. So I'll sort of work our way through those questions here. The first one on the things that we're keeping sort of doing computing up at night. I think the big topics, as we discussed, were large raw data volumes, right, coming out of the FAR detector, which is, you know, not quite LHC exabyte scale, but sort of still big, sort of a tenth of high luminosity LHC type scales. You know, the second one on not adequately using GPUs, coprocessors, or HPCs. You know, this was in the context of low level data processing, but I think that's sort of a broad general concern. One about sort of, you know, making sure there's sort of unity in the frameworks and compatibility in the frameworks between the near and far detectors, encodings, formats, DAC systems, etc. A specific large data challenge related to supernovas, where we expect to record a very large amount of data in a short amount of time and then have to do something with it on a pretty quick timescale. And then questions of how you deal with identity and authentication across a large international collaboration. And then this big concern, which I'll certainly echo, which is whether or not there is support for the sort of software development and from physicists or from professionals to enable a lot of the things above, right? Because many of these issues are sort of software issues, right? And you need support for the people to be able to do those things. Okay, so let me pause here and ask if there are questions from folks on the computing side on these topics.
I'd just like to point out that we actually have two scale problems. One is the raw volume of all of the data, which is an LHC times 10%. The other one, which is actually more severe, is that our smallest unit of data that you need for processing is about a factor of 10 larger than an Atlas mass event. And actually just shoving on an individual core, shoving what we need to do onto that core is quite memory intensive. And I think those are two orthogonal but equally nasty problems.
Alex, could you explain what is meant by the 6-hour turnaround time for the 200 terabytes of Supernova?
Yes, I'll take a shot. I mean, the idea is that, you know, once you record the data, you want to know in a pretty short timescale what, you know, which direction that, you know, because you get some pointing information from a subset of supernova neutrino interactions. So you want a pretty quick turnaround to analyze that data and point back at where that supernova might be coming from, because neutrinos serve as an early warning system for supernovas. So there is a need to you know, at least do some level of processing on it pretty quickly to provide feedback to the rest of the world. Question for Peter?
Yeah, I was just on Heidi's comment. I mean, when you say minimal unit of processing, I mean, that's not the entire event, or, I mean, that's...
Oh, God, no. That's 1/150th of a signal module.
Okay.
Okay, if there's not other questions on from computing on this, are there other folks from SBND or other neutrino experiments that have, you know, comments on these or other sort of related worries?
These are, so speaking for Wes and I, these definitely keep us up at night. I think there are a few other things as well. One of them is, you know, one of the things that we're really worried about is, as Fermilab is sort of developed as like the data storage hub for the intensity frontier, the small to mid-scale intensity frontier experiments, that means that we have a lot of our data sitting at Fermilab on tape, and then we need to move all of that data to an HPC center for getting processing in the future. And how one does that migration from these data centers to these computing centers is definitely something that worries us, especially if, and this becomes the second thing that keeps us up at night, tape is still the sort of data storage technology of choice. Just the IO challenges of reading stuff off of tape, streaming it to a computing center, and then writing it back onto tape becomes sort of like completely limiting for like even the SBN program, much less future small to mid-scale intensity frontier experiments. So those two sort of, I think, are somewhat correlated, but are definitely things that worry me. And then just the last one is the concept of software longevity. If we are only allowed to process our data at the low level once, and we have an experiment which is spanning, you know, decades, are we able to, you know, reread that file that we wrote a decade ago with future software? I'm sure that's a solvable problem, but is definitely something that worries at least me. Pitch to Wes to see if he had any other things to add.
So I have I'll pause for Wes, and then I've got a hand from Heidi and Kyle.
No, I've got nothing to really add there. I think both of you have covered many of the major issues.
I'll say even from Nova, which is a generation earlier, we're also starting to worry about these issues of throughput from tape. Heidi.
Yeah, I'm just going to say that Dune philosophy, which involves pulling in the international collaborators, is actually to try to maintain copies of the most recent data samples on disk. But it means that we're asking our international collaboration to pitch in something on the order of 18 petabytes of disk. This is not necessarily, and then we have to figure out how to use and deliver that. But that's part of our philosophy, is really to go international, and by aggregating resources worldwide, be able to actually keep most of the recent samples on disk. That's something that I think the smaller experiments might want to think about, but it's going to take real discipline in data lifetimes. So that, you know, samples are going to go away. And we ain't going to let users just restage old stuff from disk. On the long term, I think another thing that Kirby didn't bring up, but I think is something that we're running. Well, he did bring it up. One of the things is that, I mean, root may be going towards this RN tuple data format. We're also looking at most of the machine learning programs seem to like to look at HDF5 rather than root. And one question is, you know, the maintainability and diversity that we're beginning to encounter in data formats, because if you want to use commercial software, you sometimes have to use a different data format. I didn't put this in my slides either, but it's something we're running into. And we're now writing ART HDF5 interfaces in order to do some of this.
All right, thank you, Kyle.
It wasn't originally what my question was, but I was curious to hear a little bit about thoughts about different forms of compression and, you know, things that we, as you know, often have tried to avoid, but, you know, as we get into these new data regimes, there's ideas of kind of, you know, even lossy compression or something like that to enable some physics. But the thing that I was originally going to ask was my understanding from the neutrino side is that in terms of, like, you know, actually testing theories and various things, that there's a lot of, like, nuclear physics confusion and et cetera, and that the simulation associated to that is a pretty big, you know, a pretty big challenge in terms of, like, you might have to just re-simulate a ton of data under, like, some different nuclear physics model or something. So I was curious where that kind of fits into your thoughts. And then also if you had any comments about kind of being able, like, I don't know, either, preserving analyses or reusing them and reinterpreting them, if there's anything, like, where, whatever, any comments you want to make on that side.
I mean, I can speak to that somewhat. The idea of having to, just in any context, systematic samples, that really freaks me out. And I think that that sort of fits into that same sort of high throughput computing worry, is how one can generate a simulation rapidly to be able to do that. And then, you know, write it to tape or run it to a HPC center for processing and then analyze it. So I think that those are two big things, or that's a big thing. I won't touch on the compression question, and I've completely blanked on what your third point was.
The third one is about just kind of being able to either preserve the analyses that have been done for either reproducibility or reinterpretation and things along those lines.
Yeah, and I do think that comes with that software longevity. One of the things that we've been trying to do on the SBN is create very, very small and not like shared analysis file. It's something that we've picked up from Nova and something that I know that Dune's picking up, these CAF files for those that are in the know. And the idea being that we could hold on to those for very long periods of time to enable sort of analysis reproducibility. But to be able to go back down to like the raw or even like the signal processed would be a definite challenge.
You know, I can jump in and say on the subject of, you know, analysis reproducibility, there's folks from, particularly from Minerva, who are thinking very seriously about this, how you do data archiving so that, you know, particularly for cross-section measurements, you can think about reanalyzing them again in the future, which goes to this question of nuclear physics uncertainties. And we had a whole workshop on that a little while ago, so we can probably pull some, you know, there was some detailed information that came out of that we can probably pull. So Peter, your hand's been up for a while, but I suspect it's a new topic of discussion and that Heidi and Wes are following up on this one.
No, I was wanting to ask a question. I was waiting patiently.
Yeah, so I think Heidi and Wes have follow-ups on this question from Kyle, so I was going to jump to them and then circle back to you, Peter, if that's okay.
Sure.
All right, Heidi.
Oh, okay, just a second while I get back this. This is actually something where I think we have something in common, not so much with Atlas, but probably with LHCb and Bell too, is that, you know, I haven't thought about this much recently, but if we're going to, I think reweighting is a very good idea for simulations, but you don't just want to reweight the total cross-section. You want to reweight the total cross-section as a function of the kinematics of the final state event. And, you know, Bell is going to need to do, but we're small enough. We're like Bell events, not like Alice or Atlas events. And so I think it's computationally tractable to do that, but I don't know what efforts are going on to effectively come up with reweighters that don't just reweight the total cross-section, but actually reweight based on the kinematics of the event. And I might add, I haven't thought about this recently, but it seems like that's something where we have something in common with a lot of the other experiments.
Yeah, right, that's interesting. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I'll just quickly say that a lot of the reweighting, and I think Flavor often as it seems like at a level where you have kind of tractable reweighting, but there is some work being done about reweighting using some machine learning based techniques for like Atlas and CMS in a more like multivariate, you know, differential sort of way.
Yeah, just to kind of follow up on this line of thinking. I mean, I think that Alex and Heidi have kind of covered it well. The other thing that I'll add, especially with respect to liquid argon TPCs, is I am somewhat optimistic that as we continue to mature the reconstruction and analysis techniques, that we will be able to make improvements on some of the ways in which we do simulation and ways that we can approach some of these analysis modeling sort of questions and analysis things, which are also all very much tied to the underlying simulation to begin with. And this is largely because I think in many respects in liquid argon TPCs, we've been hesitant about working from anything but the very closest to the raw levels of data from the detector, and then kind of going through full processings and reprocessings based on that as we've developed techniques. And that hesitancy is borne out by the complications that come with really, you know, these really sensitive detectors. But I think as we gain some more maturity on that, I think that we'll be able to make improvements along those lines. And I think using machine learning type things, as you mentioned, you know, those are definitely among the types of things that people are actively looking at, along with, you know, and that also speaks to the higher level sort of compression, I think, that you were talking about, Kyle, where we should be able to get smarter about the types of information that we really need to keep long term, or that are typically used as part of processing. I'm hopeful that's the case, at least.
All right, thanks. So I was now going to go to Peter Boyle to pick up a new question, and then to Peter Onisi. I see your hand up too.
Sure. I'm assuming that the use of HPC resources is kind of non-negotiable. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is there anything you can do to, or that Snowmass could do to recommend modifications or access to influencing HPC resources? For example, if you had a large tape store in the same room with a fronting large disk system, it might be easier than shoving remotely. And if we were able to express an opinion on the balance between the volume of resource in GPU and the volume of resource in CPU, for example, have you got any thoughts on that?
I have some thoughts, unless someone else wants to jump in.
Go for it, Alex. I'll follow up.
All right. So what I'll say is that I think my sense from DOE is that the push to HPCs is pretty non-negotiable. The thing that I have been worrying about on this front is, CPU and GPU, I think, is a very hard thing to judge at this stage. The thing that has been worrying me about it is what the access model is, because, you know, these days, anyone who joins Dune or Nova or SBND gets access to Fermilab and gets access to the Fermilab grid. But there are, you know, each HPC center has its own additional hoops required to get access, which means that they are just not, they're not well suited to the current production, you know, the current models of how collaborations, you know, use computing. There's a similar challenge that that writing software that uses those machines effectively is its own additional challenge that most businesses currently do not know how to do. And so I worry a lot about, you know, access model and then either the direct support to write software frameworks that allow physicists to write code they understand that works efficiently, or training to be able to use those effectively. Those are the things that worry me a lot, right? That we're sort of being pushed to this new computing paradigm that isn't quite as natural a fit to particle physics, and that we need to think through those things. Then there are, of course, technical worries too about how you get the data to the site and then back out of it. I mean, at this stage, I mean, you know, you worry about, as was brought up earlier, multiple bottlenecks. There's first a bottleneck getting the data off of the tape, and then bottlenecks getting the data staged to the HPC centers, as well as some software compatibility problems between Fermilab storage and those HPCs. So I have a bunch of worries about HPCs, though they're not quite your worries, Peter. And if there's something that we can put into the report,
I worry about those things too. I mean, I think the basic principle is if they're going to try and take the job from you, they have to take your trust model, right? You know, you have a trust model, you trust your experiment partners, you know, all the people you're giving access to, and they're sort of taking the load, but they're not taking the responsibility, or, you know, if they're not trusting the people that you trust.
Yeah, I mean, there's also this sort of movement, there's a difference between distributing resources via, you know, sort of Condor Fair Share versus distributing resources via proposal, you know, specific task proposal driven requests. That's another sort of mismatch between the way we have done computing and the way that the HPC centers have typically been operating. Right. So, I mean, this is really the single broad stroke worry is that the HPC computing model is just very different in many regards from the OSG computing model. And it is not clear that all of the pieces it seems like that getting those things reconciled is not going to happen automatically by itself.
I mean, I would make an argument. I mean, you mentioned, and I think I also mentioned the CPU GPU porting, which we have three exascale or three large systems going in, each of which have a different GPU programming model from each other. The cost, you know, if you look at the volume of software, the most cost effective proposition is to get the bulk of the compute done, but not necessarily to get all of the code base changed, right? Because there's really a lot of code. So, you know, it surely is expensive to do everything.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, I've talked a lot on this. So I hanged him up from Stephen, which I'm guessing is follow-up here.
It's actually a new question.
If it's a new question, I'll pause and see if there's any more follow-up on this.
Yeah, I can add I'll just add a quick follow-up. I mean, I think Alex, I think that you're certainly right on with respect to enabling the current, people working on the experiments, particularly students and postdocs who we end up relying on to do a lot of the work. It's nice to be able to throw them access at a computing resource and they're motivated to figure things out to learn to do things. And so I think there is definitely a education and sort of workflow component with respect to the people there. On the broader picture too, I think one of the things that I think about, I think that was going to some of what you were saying, Peter, is really thinking about the full chain of things from the data from the detector all the way through the full reconstruction, analysis, reanalysis, all of these things and all of these steps, and where all of the different, really kind of understanding where all the different sort of bottlenecks are and where the different optimizations need to happen. I think that sometimes we get into a mode where we think in particular chunks of the computing model and of the data pieces, and making sure that we also are considering that broader view of that is, I think, really critical. And then I think then speaks to those sort of optimizations about what the things that are going to buy us improvements in the future. which will then also change over the future. And I'll admit, I don't think that we've been struggling with this on SPN. I think that we lack good, robust modeling of our computing in that sort of end-to-end sort of view. And so we can make predictions about and kind of understand, how much processing time per event and basic ideas on data IO and things like that. But really having, those predictions, don't always bear out with respect to, actually gluing everything and all of the pieces together. And that's something I think that we need to be working on.
All right. Thanks very much. I think now it will, unless there's a burning follow-up, I want to move to the next question from Peter Onisi.
Hi, yes. I mean, this is actually going back a bit in time, but sort of related to Kyle's question. If one's shooting for long-term, preservation of and reproducibility of analyses, of course, it helps to have the analyses already use as inputs and workflow, what you would like to preserve. And I'm just wondering to what extent that's been thought about at all, or whether there are existing experiments that you would like to use as models, or, to what extent can you sort of bake in, the ability to preserve, the final inputs for, your analysis in a way that people don't have to do extra work at the end to preserve them.
All right. Well, for lack of someone else responding, I've seen a bunch of talks on this at FISTAT workshops, and the work being done at the LHC on these sort of, serializable analysis framework seems very cool. But I think I don't know of anybody in Neutrinos who's taken a serious crack at those things yet. My two cents is that part of the trouble here is that at least for sort of multi-detector oscillation analyses would require pretty substantial work on those, serializable frameworks in order to make those sort of analyses storable. And since that work has not happened yet, as you might imagine, taking an existing analysis in its own sort of bespoke framework and reporting it into one of those schemes is extraordinarily challenging. So I don't know of anybody who's done that yet.
I mean, it's not necessarily saying, that people have to have done it yet, but I'm sort of wondering if that's something that's baked into, the plans for what people are recommended to do. I mean, to some extent, of course, what the experience at the LHC was, people came up with whatever they needed to do in the end to do analysis, which was not, in fact, what the original model that was, people had for how people were going to do analysis, of course. So these things are all, often grow organically. But once they've grown, in that way, then it can be very, very hard to, as you said, to make any changes to it. So, I mean, it seems like, a reasonable opportunity to try and get ahead of the curve. But...
I know. I read that as feedback to the Neutrino folks from computing that this is the thing that might be valuable for us to do. I certainly agree that it might be valuable to do, ahead of, and it's, as you say, it's much easier to do ahead of time than after the fact. But I may defer to the Dune computing folks on where we are in thinking about this as policy. All right, question from Stephen.
So this is a question related to reproducibility. And also for the data volume and the heterogeneous formats, how much of that relates to sharing data between experiments and reproducibility, across experiments versus entirely internal to experiments, and just public data sharing is not what you do. Is that on radar at all?
Let's say right now, we're not looking at, Dune is not looking at public data sharing, although, it's not impossible. You just can't share 30 petabytes very easily. But I think in data, yes.
Are there any challenges related to, you know, Dune formats versus Minerva formats, et cetera? Or is that just, it's so small and so standard, it's a non-issue?
Oh, the Minerva, I mean, as somebody who deals with the Minerva format, it's completely experiment dependent. It just has a lot of access methods. They're completely different frameworks. In principle, one could go that way, but I will say within Dune, our problem right now is actually going to be just sharing data between the various components of the near and far detectors is also a challenge.
And I also have a follow-up question about the data transport between the different centers. How much of that is a literal bandwidth problem, either between the centers or to and from tape, versus a problem of the tools and automation to make that easy?
Both. Dune is right now trying to figure out how to use all the disk we've managed to get. And writing the tools to do that is a major part of our software effort right now. Those tools should be usable by any intensity frontier experiment once we get them done. But it's a major effort because you're dealing with something that we have like 32 compute sites, and at this point about 10 disk sites, and making certain that everything's tuned so it works is a really major effort. Right now we're mainly using streaming, by the way. But in principle, you can also bring the files across using several different mechanisms. And underneath it all, we're planning to use Rusio for the big file movement.
All right. I don't see any more questions. Oh, is there a follow-up?
If I can, yeah, just, I mean, just to, so Stephen, sorry, thank you. This is, I mean, on the comparisons across experiments, I think is a really great point. I mean, I think many of those comparisons have been done in terms of thinking about like final global fits on oscillation parameters, or in final cross-section model tuning and tools for doing that. And so that there is some work on that front, but I think that there's certainly issues and things that come up there. I think that with respect to particularly the liquid argon TPCs, this is something that we should be thinking about in that community. There's a unique opportunity here that we are all using a base software right now in Larsoft, and that we are kind of speaking a common language in both the simulation and reconstruction and a lot of these data formats. So there is an opportunity to be thinking, about these kinds of comparisons across, the measurements that these detectors will be making in the future. And so that's something, I think that's something that needs some more specific attention. But there is sort of an overall broader, issue as well, especially in comparisons to other experiments.
All right. Thanks very much. I think we had a lot of very good discussion on this. I think we spent maybe a slightly outsized amount of time on it, but I think these questions of what are the things that worry us are probably the most important piece of place to discuss. So I'm now going to move on to sort of the next question topic. We touched on some of these things, right? What do we need? What is the message? What things from NF are we trying to make sure end up in the CompF reports? And this touches on some of the things we were discussing already. Sort of to pull on Kirby's slide, the reminder here, right, is that the first note is that there are software needs for Dune and neutrino experiments that go beyond what is needed for the LHC, and there needs to be some particular support for that development, right? That it's real work, and right now it's not clear that the funding is in place to get people to do that work. For example, there's no sort of neutrino involvement in IRIS-HEP, and we want to make sure that we're not missed in the next piece of it. As you've heard sort of here, right, neutrinos are divided into a large number of experiments, but a lot of the issues are common, and a lot of the tools that get developed can be used in a common way. Larsoft crosses over among, the liquid argon experiments, but a lot of these sort of grid and job and data management can be shared even beyond just the liquid argon experiments. So there is room to leverage development that has an eye towards Dune to helping sort of all of the neutrino community. you know, and so that's I think most, you know, I look at these bullets and there's sort of seven bullets, pretty much all of which say that it's important that there is the thing that's important that goes into the report is the need for software support for developing the tools for doing neutrino computing in this new era where the computing is changing and the data volumes are increasing. So let me pause there and ask if there are questions. As I said, we touched on some of these things already before, but along the lines of what information do we needs to go into the report, and maybe first either questions from computing folks or other ideas from neutrino folks on other things we want to make sure are addressed in the reports. All right, well, I will remind again that we discussed it at some length, but these questions about, you know, in the world of us being, you know, being pushed to use HPCs as our major computing source, that there's a lot of model mismatch in the way that we have done computing and the way that the HPCs work. And it's quite important that we put some work into addressing those issues. Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to repeat myself a little bit, but it's clear that this comes with a human effort cost, right? So if there's a decision, if the decision is made in this way, that this is how the compute is going to be provisioned, there has to be a quantification of the cost that comes with that in order to make it work.
So I think if I go to this slide of Kirby's, which is around, so that was around requirements. There, you know, Dune has put some estimates into the level of FTE required for Dune computing. I may defer to Heidi to give please, details here. So there's some thought has been put into the details. Heidi, please go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, I was just saying, one of the things about the HPC utilization is I think that using, I mean, well, so one thing, Dune has conflicting requirements, which are that we're supposed to be getting 75% of our computing outside the US for also supposed to be using the HPCs. And those cause us some conflict is that, you know, how much effort. I think the thing we're thinking about doing is really concentrating on using the HPCs for particular parts of a very complex workflow. They may be very good at the beginning where you're trying to perform, you know, basically matrix operations in Fourier transforms on digitized signals. And they may be very good in the middle when you're trying to run very large machine learning algorithms across multiple cores. And they may be very good at the end when you're trying to extract parameters, but they're going to be steps where they aren't so good. And I don't think there's any place in our workflows where we want to be completely dependent on HPC, partially due to the funding mechanism and planning mechanisms that come up with HPCs. Is that if we're running, especially now that we're running test beams, I mean, you just don't want to have to wait 6 months for your allocation to come up in order to analyze the data that came out of your test beam that you took last week. So it's a real sort of chicken and egg problem, is we can't be completely dependent on HPCs, but we want to use them.
If I may comment, that reassures me because you have a hybrid computing in the mix. Right. I think it's clear that not all the code, not every job can run on the HPC. So if you're able to reserve it for the portion of the workflow that is quite well suited to, then it makes sense as a strategy.
So I have maybe a question along these lines, which is, and it may be a thing to, for, you know, crossover between neutrino and computing. How confident are we that that scale of computing is going to be, of high throughput computing is going to be available internationally on Dune timescales, right? You know, it's not exactly a snowmass question, but if we're counting on, you know, the EU and in Canada or whatever providing high throughput computing, are they in fact planning to provide that level of computing?
We don't know. We're assuming at this point, we're basically assuming it's the US complex that wants to do this.
Right. I mean, so this is sort of my worry that if the directive is you need to get 3/4 of your computing internationally, but that computing may not be there, then what do we do?
We basically design our code to always run off, not on HPCs. The other problem is how the very different architectures and Other issues are getting the data in and out, database access, just a completely different computational model.
Indeed. All right, Joaquin?
Yeah, so I should probably comment on HPCs. So, I mean, probably people know, at least at NERSC, the next machine, NERSC 10 that we're planning, kind of is making a focus of being good for workflows and for experimental data analysis. So there's certainly an opportunity there to feed in some of these as use cases for pushing, and also having a vision of, you know, not just providing flops, but also measuring, you know, sort of the capability that we have in terms of other things like data transfer and workflow software and services, edge service provision for databases and so forth. I think the other HPC centers are also kind of pivoting that way to a certain extent and already have to some extent. I think there's an opportunity there. On the other hand, I think obviously it's not good to be fully dependent on these. Although actually there are some experiments that are fully dependent on HPC centers and manage to kind of make it work, or at least like largely dependent, like LZ or DESI or who have you. But there definitely are struggles, and also from the kind of multi-user nature of somewhere like NERSC, I mean, it's not a dedicated resource. Although there again, there are some attempts to have resilient systems and resources that are always on for particular workloads, urgent computing needs. So that's with a kind of NERSC hat on, but then with the facilities COMPARE4 hat on, I think this is exactly kind of what we want to talk about, like what interfaces are needed to enable the use of like diverse systems, you know, and ideally the same interfaces can be used at different types of sites.
Wahid, could you prepare a list of the experiments that are using NERSC? And perhaps let us know if there are reports about their experiences.
Sure, yeah. I think at some Snowmass event, Debbie put a list of at least who's using NERSC. So I can dig that out for you.
But in all fairness,
I'm one of them with DESI. You're welcome to contact me. This is Stephen Bailey.
All right. Other comments or questions on this topic? I mean, circling back to this question of what do we want to put in the report? I mean, my takeaway from this, right, is that we are worried about what appears to be growth only in HPCs and not in high throughput computing in the US, right? And that growth does not seem to be accompanied with the support to be able to move over to a computing model that looks like that for neutrino experiments. I don't know if that is exactly a recommendation not to put some more growth into high throughput computing, or whether that is effort that needs to go into helping us transition or you know, what all that looks like. But I think there is, my read is there's sort of a worry brewing here that is worth touching on.
Can I just say, I mean, there are HPCs and there are HPCs. NERSC is particularly friendly as an HPC site because they tend to buy conventional CPU nodes and they buy an accelerated portion, and they strike a balance, you know, so they have a nice, you know, I commented earlier about, you know, hybrid or having the right mix, and NERSC actually do that very well. Some of the European HPC sites have only CPU, but the accelerated HPC nodes are the things that really scare me. So NERSC are the good guys.
All right. So this was on the topic. So circling back more generally, this topic was, you know, things that we want to make sure end up in the computing report. If there's anything else, Heidi, is that an old hand?
What?
You still have a hand up. I want to make sure you wouldn't.
Sorry.
All right, that's fine. So I'll suggest we move on to the next question, which is about what requirements projections are out there that we might be able to related to software computing that folks can be aware of. So I said Dune, I think my guess is that Dune has done the most careful work on this front. And I've pulled up this slide here. I don't know if Heidi wants to comment or if there's been updates to these things, but this is sort of the you know, talking about the scale of storage by tape and by disk and of CPUs expected, you know, on sort of the time scale, right? So this takes us up to about 2030, which is sort of early days of Dune. I don't know that we have thought seriously of what Dune in its heyday is going to need in terms of computing. I'm not even sure we're in a place to make that prediction.
The slides I posted actually have the extrapolation to 40, just to be scary.
You want me to pull them up? I think I can.
You can pull them up. They're on the Indico, I guess.
Yes, I think I have them.
Oh, no, actually, just look at slide 2, the next slide.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, go to the next slide. Yeah, so that just sort of shows you what happens if you start writing 30 petabytes a year. And then the good news is simulation probably, we're probably misunderestimating the simulation need. But you can just see, basically, you start taking real data and it just grows.
So I don't know, maybe a word folks from a question from the computing folks, right? Is this sort of the type of information that you need for predicting future facility needs? Is there other information you need from us on this front? Okay, thumbs up. Sounds like this is right on. So maybe this one is going to have to be sorted out in detail as we get closer to the reports. You know, like I said, and then this was the one about the expected FTE needs, which is I think, you know, as scary as the disk and computing and compute predictions are, the FTE needs also scare us. All right, then this last one of with about 10 minutes left on the question of new developments on the horizon that could drive software and computing challenges. So this first one is related to triggering and the TAQ for the near infrared detector. I think there's a lot of thought going into, you know, can we put in more sophisticated triggers that can reduce the data volume than that require needs? You need sort of online computing capable of running those more sophisticated triggers. You know, this was touched on briefly earlier, but this question of, you know, neutrino generators, you know, that we really hope there's going to be continued development on neutrino generators, both on the theory side, on the support side, and on the sort of the input data to try and make them better, right? Which comes back to this question of, you know, preserving data and reanalyzing it, right? And then I think we've talked HPCs to death quite a lot, but I think it's a thing on our radar that might drive new software and computing challenges. So let me pause and open up the floor for questions and comments. All right, Stephen.
Going back to the disk and tape needs, how much of that needs to be at any one center at any one time versus distributed across a whole bunch of different centers? And do you have like data redundancy if the same data is on disk at two different places?
This assumes that we have two copies of the most recent two reconstruction versions on disk and the rest is still back on tape. Raw data is two copies at different sites. And derived samples are one copy on tape and then two on disk. So that's why the bloat is actually having two disk copies gets challenging in terms of needing a lot of disk. But the idea is partially to have one copy in Europe and one in the US to lower the cross-Atlantic network traffic.
Mm-hmm. And especially in relation to like an HPC center, how much do you need to have on disk at one time? Hundreds of petabytes at one center or hundreds of petabytes across 10 centers?
Right now, we're spreading this across around 10 centers. And right now we're streaming our data in. We're mainly using the HPCs for things like simulation and final parameter fitting, which do not require streaming in all of the big petabytes. We do need more disk just for the outputs, because getting data in and out of the HPCs is hard. If we did end up doing some, I don't know if you can stream into these centers. If you could, then we'd be happy. Otherwise, we need to basically import, if there's a supernova, we need to import half a petabyte of data fast.
All right. Other comments or questions here on future developments and your requirements projections? If not, I was going to take these last few minutes and turn maybe to some sort of practical questions, maybe to the CompF folks. Are there more specific inputs you need from us in terms of report writing? Are there things that you want us to look at, things that you need us to write for you that we should have on our radar? Maybe we don't know yet. As reports come together, I think that as the liaison, I will try and keep my eye, but it may be a lot of material to try and keep an eye on, right? So if there are places where input might be needed or some, you know, checking of things might be needed, I think we can try and make that work. Okay, so Ben has posted in the chat a link to some notes that he was taking today, including some to-do items for a few people. It's in Google Docs, so if anyone else has some thoughts, you can feel free to edit it. And then a question to Heidi, which is, will the CDR include the computing model?
To the extent that we have a working computing model, yes. I mean, that's a major part of it. And we already, you know, the problem is we keep iterating and discovering bombs that we weren't anticipating. Like, hey, that's another thing. Hey, can we stream HDF5? Does anybody know how?
All right. Any other final questions, comments, points to discuss, things that we should be careful not to lose? Please.
I mean, I would really think carefully. I mean, it looks like, you know, the use of HPCs is non-negotiable, but you may still be able to negotiate what can you put in the room to make it easier, right? So if you put in your own Lustre file system that's somehow connected with your own software to your exterior world and try and get something in the room that you control that provides fast access to the HPC or something like that, then, you know, there may be things you can do with a bit of compromise in the other end of the pipe to make it easier, so that if you were to write down a list of, you might through Snowmass get the ability to write a list of demands to make the process simpler.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting, if I can comment, that's sort of a very interesting idea. I think it goes to the need we have right away before any of those particular resources is we need people thinking carefully about these problems so we know what it is we need in order to make the thing work smoothly. All right. Any other last comments or questions? Okie doke, in which case, why don't we wrap up just a few minutes early before folks have to go on to their next meetings. There's another new Neutrino Frontier white paper workshop starting in 4 minutes. That's on a separate Zoom, so you'll have to connect to that one. And I just wanted to thank very much all the folks from Computing and Neutrinos who came here today to have this very interesting chat. So, bye, everybody.
Yeah, bye. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye-bye.